So we're in the center of this grand book, the letter to the Roman Church by the Apostle Paul. And I think Paul is fairly clear, and I would encourage you to take chapter 6. It might make sense for you to just copy and paste it in a Word document, print it off, unless you have a Bible that you're comfortable marking things up on, and then just sit with it and say, yeah, so okay, how does this work? Underline that truth, see how it fits into this. Paul's fairly straightforward, fairly logical, but he is writing 2,000 years ago. He's writing in Greek, he's a Hebrew. And there's a lot of translation problems, but not insurmountable. And we all know that good information is important. In fact, you can't calculate the importance of having the right information if you are making an important decision, right? Now, if you're not out impulse buying when you buy a new car, and you've done your homework and research, that's important. There are some things to know about vehicles before you purchase them. And the better your information, the better decision you're going to make. How is it then, when we come to this, the state, the eternal state of our souls, that we fail to get good information, or perhaps having the information, we don't pay attention to it. We don't make that a priority. And I encourage you not to let that be you. There are some very important decisions that you make every day about your eternal well-being, the state of your soul, the state of your spirit, the state of your heart, and the state of your mind. Guinness writes this book called Fat Bodies, or Fit Bodies and Fat Minds, and he relates how when he was giving, Oz Guinness, he was giving a little lecture or a speech, and some lady in the Q&A period, some exercise lady raises her hand and says, how's your body? And he says, Madam, how is your mind? That's the important question. Fit bodies, fat minds. His critique, being English and all, his critique of the North American way of being in the world. But a great way of highlighting the irony about our priorities. Let's face it. Where's this little evil thing? Ah, there we go. We spend hours chasing down and researching all sorts of things on this or its equivalent, you know, larger or even an actual old-fashioned computer with a keyboard and all. How much time do we chase down these bits of information? Now, if you're perfect, great. I take all that back. You got no worries. But if you're still in process, good information means good decisions, good choices. I think Paul is clear. Go home. Work through Romans 6. Last week we heard Paul saying very clearly, if you've died with Christ, and that's what it means to be baptized into Christ, were you baptized? Yes. Then that means you identified with the death of Christ, a death to sin. Consider yourself, where we ended off last week, consider yourself dead to sin. That's the truth. That's a fact, Jack. And so he's picking up on that when he says, now therefore, don't let sin reign. He knows it's not quite so simple. He knows it's not a matter of being an irrefutable fact in our existence. And so he wants us to use the information in a good way. Don't let sin rule, because sin no longer has mastery. And that's the wonderful thing about being in Christ, is that God has restored to us the dignity of choice. We can choose sin. That's the problematic part of our Christian journey. It's still a live option for us, but we don't have to. There's no must. There's no tyranny, there's no obligation, there's no mastery of sin in our lives. We've been set free so that we can choose to serve God. And Paul's very practical in that. It's these members, the parts of your body that are given over to sin to be a servant or a slave of sin. Take those same parts. Give them over to God as servants of righteousness. Very practical. I think you can work through this. I encourage you to do it. I don't want to talk more about these very practical and what I think are somewhat straightforward pieces of information that Paul has given us, information that's critical and crucial to your eternal well-being. You got that? I think I've stressed that 3 times now. Good information leads to good choices. The category, the topic here is your eternal well-being, your eternal destiny. Instead, I wanted to talk about something that I've been coming back to virtually every time I've talked, read Romans in the last, 3-4 years. It's verse 14. It's set up, so Paul is saying, yeah, you've died to sin, therefore don't let sin reign. Instead, like I said, give these members of your body over, not to sin, but over to God first, as a slave to righteousness, servant to righteousness. And then he says, verse 14, because of what I've already told you, sin is not to be master over you, because, here's a new piece of information, because you are not under law, but under grace. And that's the piece I'm like, I'm reading this and I'm like, how does that work? So Paul says, sin won't have mastery over you. This is why you shouldn't give yourself over as a servant to sin, because sin is no longer Lord or master. Why is sin no longer Lord and master? Well, he's already told us, because I died to sin, but now he's telling me something new. He's saying, sin won't be your master, finally, and today, because you're no longer under law, but you're under grace. So there's something about being under law that ties me to sin, and that's a piece that I'm trying to sort of wrestle with, and I want to talk a bit more about that. So how does this work? Well, in Romans 1 and 2, Paul tells us that all of humanity lives under a sense of the law of God. Now, the Jewish people had a revelation from God, and their accountability is vastly greater than the rest of the world. But Paul says all humanity has within them a recognition of God, his glory, his invisible attributes, and they know the moral law. And they either choose to ignore that or to live out of that. And they carry within them the law written in their hearts, says Paul. So here's the way the law functions. This is why the law ties us to sin. Everybody's under law, either the law, Mosaic law, or the law as being a creature and having built into us an awareness of God and having the environment, the world, show us and demonstrate that God is this good, beautiful, and vastly superior to us entity. How does the law tie us to sin? Well, it goes this way. There's 2 categories of humans, and I'm convinced that all of us are in one or two of these categories. The first category, I think by far the majority, knows that they aren't good enough. They know the law, they know what's right, and they know they fail. And so they live their entire life in the shadow, in the legacy, in the trajectory of that having failed. They're like, I know I should this, and I can't, and I didn't, and I won't, or I'm not able to. And after a while, of course, you just sort of give in to that. And so the law ties us to sin because it reminds us, you aren't good enough, you failed. And what do you do when you failed? You say, to heck with it, and you just, boom, away I go. Or you find all sorts of sinful behaviors to pretend that's not true about you. You find ways of numbing yourself. You find addictive things that stimulate and promote some understanding of yourself that's false, because the real you is not very nice and you don't like the real you. So you spend all this time building a different you, and this is all sin. Now, it's not all like axe murder sin or, you know, these sorts of things, but it's still sin. It's a denial of God. It's a denial of what's true about you. To lie is to sin, right? You understand that? I know we're in the 21st century in Canada, but it's still a sin to lie. I'm just going to tell you. And so we're caught, we're trapped in sin because we're under the law. Now the other part, which is actually in some ways more serious, is that you discover that you can make the law work for yourself. And there are those people. Paul himself says, I was faultless according to the law before I met Jesus. Really, Paul? Faultless. I mean, I've read that law. Jesus, you might remember, had a rich young man, come and say, how do I inherit life? And Jesus said, here's some good commandments. And he says, from my youth, I've kept these. So there are people who operate that way according to the law. Now, the problem with the law, so the first half can't be good. The law tells them you can't be good. The second part is, this is the irony, the law says you can't be good without getting proud or self-righteous and critical and judgmental. And so the people for whom the law works become very full of themselves, very indifferent to the needs of others, and quite critical and judgmental. It happens absolutely. Those are sins, by the way. Pride, lack of charity, criticism, judgmentalism. You know, this is how this works, right? So the first one is like, I'm a failure. I can never measure up. I might as well just resign myself to that and live in despair or indulge it, you know, just run, just go crazy. The second person says, no, the law, that's practical, that's good stuff. And if you're as self-determined as I am and have the strength of will, you too can do it. Shame on you for not being that way. And that's the sort of world that they live in. And both people are trapped in a cycle of sin because they're still under the law. Grace removes that. But here's the problem. The first person, convinced of their unworthiness, disbelieves grace, can't accept it, can't receive it, says, well, that can't be right. And God just says, hey, let me love on you. Let me tell you how beautiful you are in my image of you and how great the future is that I have for you. And you're like, it can't be right. I don't want to be a fool. I don't want to believe some silly pipe dream. I don't want to deceive myself, be delusional. And we say no to grace because we can't receive it. We really, actually, if you want to be truthful about it, two things are going on. One, we're tied to an addictive cycle where we need our need in order to justify our acting out in our drug of choice, whatever that is. And that could be shopping, that could be eating, that could be any number of other things. We're not talking just psychedelics or whatever, mind-altering substances. There's any number of things because our dopamine in our brain works on all sorts of stimulus, and so we need the need to justify our addictive cycle. The other is, and I think more importantly, we've so identified ourselves with being a failure that we don't know any other us. We don't know how to be different. And if you've ever worked with people who work with addictions and struggle with addictions, you'll find that you run up against this wall. That's just the way I am. But it's not just that, those worst case scenarios. We're all that way. We come to somebody and we say, you just need to learn who I am and how I am, and then we'll get along okay. Don't expect me to be patient. I'm not that kind of person. Whatever it is, we justify and excuse ourselves. And I think not just because we're self-obsessed, that's always a possibility. I think because we're desperately afraid that we can't change. We've accepted the law. The law tells us we're not good. And we said, yes, I'm not good. That's me. And I live out of that identity, even though I try very hard to pretend that isn't the case. If I want to be very honest and get right down to the root of it, before you or before God or before myself, I'll admit that I can't hope for change. For me, it's not possible. And that means you just said no to grace. There is no such thing. That is not an operative principle in the universe. It's not an option in my life. And so we're locked into sin. Now, why is Paul talking about this? Paul's talking about this because though he says, here's what God did in Jesus Christ, and I want you to take this information and run with it, he knows there are people who are going to continue to struggle and continue to fail. And he says, you need to get out of that mentality that's trying to earn itself and its way into salvation. Prove itself. Jesus tells this parable about a man who owes a massive debt to his master, and he begs for forgiveness. His master says, you're free. He goes out, immediately grabs a fellow slave who owes him just a pittance, throws him into prison, won't accept his plea for forgiveness because he did not believe in grace. He did not believe he was forgiven. He didn't internalize that. So that's a struggle for us. The other person also is tied to an identity of being good. But ironically, the person who makes the law work for them and is proud has to keep working hard because the law doesn't quit. I can't just say, yeah, I did that yesterday. I got to do it today and tomorrow. And they too, and if you remember your own children or if you've ever worked with children, there are children who try desperately hard to please, always with the right person. And sometimes you want to just say, listen, go screw up. I don't care. Go screw up. I'm going to come. I'm going to love you anyways. And we can get that out of the way. Because right now you think I love you because you're so good. And you are good, and I like that, especially compared to your brother. But you want to do that. You want that child to have the freedom of knowing they're okay because of who they are, not because of what they do. And the person who's tied to sin through the law on this side resists grace because they don't trust it as well, but they also don't want it. They've tied their identity to being better than other people. That's who they are. Oh, sure, they can pretend that we're all okay. We're all equal after all, aren't we? Yeah, right. As if. You know, have you checked that person out? Like, in no way I'm equal to them. And we don't want grace, because grace means this, that I stand before God in heaven and the axe murderer shows up. And God says, welcome, beloved servant. Enter into the joys of your master. And I'm like, what, him? What the heck? Me? No. I don't want in if you're letting him in. Huh? Really? No, that attitude is not a caricature, unfortunately. There are those of us who hate grace because it means that I'm truly unequal to everyone else on the planet. The worst. The Hitlers. The Stalins. The Ted Bundys. Really? All humanity, I think, is in one of these networks of sin, trapped because of the law. The only way out is grace. Some of us can't believe it. It's just too good to be true. That I can quit trying, can quit earning, can quit carrying the shame, the burden of my guilt, the unfixable things from the past. Some of us don't want to let go of the thrill of being the best. We both are locked into sin because we're not under grace. And Paul says, listen, if you're struggling with sin and gaining the victory, I've already told you you're dead to sin. I've told you to consider it that way and to not continue to submit yourself as a servant to sin. If that's the impossible solution for you, then Paul says, listen, you resist grace at some level. Can you receive grace? Can you receive the unconditional love of God, a love that never ends, that'll never say, oh, but since you this, then I won't that. I'll remove my love because you've done this. There are no doubt. There is none of that. before God. Nothing I can do that'll change his love for me. You need to believe that and lose yourself in it. And that may be the missing ingredient in your life, my life, our life. We'll still struggle with sin. There's still a warfare, but the back will be broken because we've quit trying. And we've quit trying because we've realized we do not need to earn God's favor. You don't need to earn God's favor. You don't. He loves you. Won't you be open today to his grace?